time for Yakety Science.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Yakety Science, the Tulsa Science Show. We are the program that shines a bright but humorous light into all of the darkest corners of the Faraday cage, the neutrino capture vessel, and Schrodinger's cat box.
Nice.
We are the show that finds the super fly in your dipterology, the slapstick in your acarology, the beautiful in your apiology, and the antic in your myrmecology.
You're getting better at these.
Yeah, so I was bad before, is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying.
Okay, excellent. I am Brian Cross, Associate Professor of Biology at Tulsa Community College and your humble host. Joining me, as always, the Hooper to my Brody, Associate Professor of Chemistry at Tulsa Community College, Matt Smith. Say hello to the nice people, Matt.
Hello, and didn't I tell you I haven't actually watched Jaws before?
Yes, you did tell me that. But you told it to me after I put that into the script.
It's true. I had to look it up.
Hooper's, of course, Richard Dreyfuss's character, who's like the scientist. You should be flattered by this because he's the scientist who supposedly knows a lot of stuff about sharks. And Brody is the chief of police who is constantly worried about people going into the water.
It's quite a bromance.
All right. And of course, it came to my mind because I watched Jaws with my family just a few nights ago, and none of them had ever seen it before. I've seen it three or four times, but not recently. And so we watched it because, of course, it's the 50th anniversary of Jaws. We are probably going to pick it up in some future episodes for a Yakety Science Ruins the Movies.
I'm sure we could find something interesting to shred it for.
Yeah, definitely. To shred it in the way that Jaws shreds hapless teens and little boys and Quint. That's got to be the best part of the whole thing is when we make Quint shut up by by consigning him to the maw of the shark. All right. What's been going on, Matt? Anything else to talk about? Have you injured yourself by shark or other means
couple of weeks? It's been my life has been drab and wretched in comparison.
So your wife locked you out of the kitchen.
There. Just no more.
So the exciting news around TCC has been the landing of the goose, which is our new mascot. We don't have a name for it yet, do we?
I don't think there is a name for it. It's just Goose, which I like it. I love the goose. I think it's fantastic.
Right, yeah. So it's a Canada goose. Where do you think this ranks on the top 10 list of all-time greatest mascots, our goose?
I don't know. Is it really going to stand up to Gritty?
What is Gritty?
Gritty is like, it's like the Philadelphia hockey mascot.
Oh, is it? Okay.
People go nuts over Gritty. He's become like a meme.
When I was a kid, for some reason, I waited in line for like an hour to get a signature from the San Diego Chicken. I don't know why. I wasn't that big of a baseball fan. I don't know. It's just when you're a kid, you're like, well, there's a guy in a chicken suit.
There's a guy in a chicken suit. I guess they do have chickens in San Diego. So probably this is fine. Unlike like a golden hurricane for TU. Yeah. What is that about? A golden hurricane?
I don't know. It doesn't really make any sense. We don't have hurricanes here.
Why are they golden?
We have tornadoes.
I don't know. But with the old mascot uniform used to be like, it looked like a bugle. You know, like the little
a cornucopia.
Yeah, a little cornucopia looking thing. It looked like a.
Of course, my daughters just started at KU, and they have the Jayhawk, which is
great.
Which is another bird mascot.
I like it.
So we have that in common. But of course, ours exists, right? Theirs doesn't. The Jayhawk.
There's no Jayhawk.
No Jayhawk.
But there are Jays.
I've heard that it's like a hybrid of a. Maybe a blue jay and a sparrowhawk or something like that. And they sort of shove those words together to give you the very engaging, charismatic mascot. I kind of like the mascot, but it is a little bit unsatisfying that it doesn't actually exist.
I like sparrowhawks. I like blue jays.
Yeah, but you can't go out into the forest and see a jayhawk. All right, well, that's it for mascots and other nonsense. How about some headlines?
Let's go to the headlines.
But first, the worms continue to eat RFK Jr.'s brain.
Matt, is there any left?
Matt, do you know which part they have eaten most recently?
Oh, well, I mean, it could be the part that's responsible for critical thinking or for feelings of shame.
Right.
Or
no, those portions were completely consumed long ago.
I mean, that's obvious.
It is now hitting the centers that hold research information that are able to retain the findings of public health studies. We're getting this from his appearance before the Senate Finance Committee this past week, in which he got into these tense exchanges about, number one, how many lives were lost due to the COVID-19 pandemic, and number two, how many lives were saved by deployment of the COVID-19 vaccines,
and
the mRNA vaccines.
He pretended that he had absolutely no idea, no data whatsoever.
Now, of course, there's some level of uncertainty with any of these public health estimates, but the idea that you don't know that a huge number of individuals died of the coronavirus and that a huge number of lives were saved by the COVID vaccines is just wrong. Someone should really teach RFK Jr. how to use PubMed or any of these other search engines or databases that provide information on public health, because the information is out there, and I thought it might be useful to share some of that data with the listeners, some of the data that RFK Jr. seems to be unaware of. Or pretends to be unaware of.
He pretends not to have the numbers, but we do.
Yeah,
so you can come to Yakety Science.
A great recent example of data that bears upon this question of how many lives were saved, how many deaths were averted by COVID-19 vaccination was published in JAMA Health Forum. This article was entitled Global Estimates of Lives and Life Years Saved by COVID-19 Vaccination During 2020 to 2024. The authors came up with a relatively conservative estimate, but even so, it was 2.5 million lives saved, 2.5 million deaths averted. So that's on the conservative end of the spectrum. Another recent study was published last fall in the journal Lancet. This came out in August of 2024. They were looking at the period of from December 2020 to April 2023, and they came up with an estimate of 1.6 million lives saved just in Europe. So they were focused on just the European region. An earlier study looking at just the first year of vaccination, that is December 2020 to December 2021, was published in the journal Lancet Infectious Diseases, and that came up with a much higher estimate. So the other end of the spectrum, about 14.4 million deaths averted according to that estimate. None of them have shown that vaccination ended up killing more people.
Right. All of these are insanely positive numbers.
Right.
None of them are negative.
This is the clear message that the public health data, that the public health research is giving us in relation to the effectiveness of the COVID vaccines. And this is something that the Secretary of Health and Human Services should be able to state plainly. Instead, RFK Jr. is out there undermining our health agencies, is undermining the CDC. We saw the recent firing of Dr. Menares, the head of the CDC, and most of the top tier of scientists at the CDC. And we see testimony like that delivered to the Finance Committee of the Senate, just undermining public confidence in these vaccines, undermining the clear consensus on the effectiveness of these mRNA COVID vaccines.
Well, right. I feel like giving an estimate for the number of people who have been killed by the COVID-19 pandemic is probably easier for people to swallow than the estimate of how many people were saved by the vaccines, because it almost feels like, just putting it out there, that you're assigning a number to a thing that didn't happen.
Right.
Like, how do we say, oh, yes, this is the number of people who would have died but didn't. Well,
right.
But they didn't die, so how do we know it was
right.
this?
There's ways of modeling this, and this is a lot of what public health officials do, and this is a lot of what you have to be familiar with if you're going to lead public health agencies. So how do they do these estimates? Well, there are different methodologies. If we look at, for instance, the JAMA Health Forum study, what they did was break the population up into a bunch of different age categories, because you know that there are different mortality risks among those different age categories. And then you start estimating things like vaccine effectiveness. You have data that bears on that. The rate of infection, right? So you estimate that. You estimate the infection mortality rate. That is, if you get the infection, how likely are you to die? And you put those estimates together to generate a number of lives saved. Other studies used different methodologies, different modeling techniques, made different assumptions, came up with different estimates. The important point to realize is that all of those different ways of modeling and all those different methodologies are giving us essentially the same answer. They're telling us that lots of lives were saved. If we step back for a moment and just set aside the harder question, which is exactly how many people were saved by the COVID vaccine, how many people would have died, and we just ask the question, are the vaccines effective? Then there we have an even clearer answer, which is just that the vaccines work. Once we deployed the vaccines, we had this clear divergence between the population that was vaccinated and the population that was unvaccinated. And that's not explained by other factors, other demographic variables, and so on. And so those who were deterred from getting the vaccine, they died at a higher rate. And so there is a real cost here. What drives me crazy is just the weaseliness of it. He never comes out and says, I am opposed to COVID vaccines. He's like, I'm just asking questions. I would love to see the data. And so really, you'd love to see the data. Well, how about you look at all of the data that the agencies that you oversee have compiled telling you that these vaccines are effective? It's very frustrating.
This
kind of, I'm just asking questions while you're undermining our ability to fight these very real threats. So, all right. So that's my tirade. All right. Another kind of worm is in our next headline here, right?
Well, let's just go for worms upon worms. What do we have next?
If you hear someone screaming, my eye is, it could mean your toddler or your spouse has accidentally forked himself in the eye. But consider that they might also be yelling, myiasis, myiasis, and just stumbling over the pronunciation. If so, you should hope that this is because they are consuming recent headlines and not because they are actually being consumed. Matt, what is myiasis?
Myiasis. I think myiasis is... It's like a personalized terrorist group. It's myiasis.
Myiasis. Yeah, it could be. so, no, it's not that. Myiasis means infestation with flies or with maggots, right?
Why?
Probably the most familiar version of this is the bot fly. So people may be aware of bot flies. If you vacation in Costa Rica or in, you know, tropical regions, you may pick up a bot fly, which is a larva that develops under the skin in a little cavity there. It can get quite big and gruesome, but it's not threatening to anyone's life. But the screwworm is a more significant problem, and the screwworm is in the headlines because we've just had the first human case of screwworm infection, of myiasis with screwworms in many decades. And this was a woman who is in Maryland but had traveled to Central America and had picked it up there. But anyway, that gave everybody the chance to talk about the fact that screwworm infections are creeping towards the southern border, a real infestation that is on its way.
So are we screwed from screwworms?
I don't know, right? So that's for others to determine. It is more of a problem, even though its scientific name.
I'm ready.
It's Cochleomyia hominovorax.
Okay.
You like that?
All right.
So hominovorax, what do you think that means?
Okay, so I see homino is human.
Yeah.
Vor is like eating, right?
Yeah. So hominovorax means man eater, right? And so it can infect humans, and it can in fact cause death in humans if it's untreated. Yeah. So
she's a man eater.
That's right. It was referring to this. Yes, it was.
that's what she does.
One of the many, many pop songs that have been written about screwworms. So hominovorax. So that's what the name means, and it can infect humans, but it's actually been much more of a problem with cattle, with livestock infestations.
Okay, so where does it burrow?
Well, it burrows into living flesh, right?
Anywhere.
So I think it looks for like an open wound, and it will lay its eggs there, and then the larvae hatch out, the maggots hatch out, and they will sort of bore their way in a kind of a spiral path right through the living flesh.
I'm going to throw up if you continue this.
It is pretty gruesome. It was eliminated in the U.S. By the 1970s, and so we haven't had it around. We haven't had to worry about it. They started a program in the 50s and kind of wrapped up in the 70s, and they actually had pushed it back all the way to, I think, to Panama or South America. Through what means? Do you know how they did this?
Did they use vaccines of some sort?
They did not use vaccines of some sort, and they did not use a giant fly swatter. They did not use big border walls composed of fly paper or anything that.
All right.
No, although that would be the obvious way to go. What they used was, this is the first real effective implementation of what's called the SIT, the SIT.
The SIT.
Yeah. You know what that stands for?
Of course I do.
Okay.
I want you to tell me what it is.
You want me to tell the listeners? You know, but you want me to tell the listeners?
Obviously.
It is the sterile insect technique. So this is the technique where you breed a lot of male flies, and then you irradiate them with X-rays, making them sterile, and then you release them into the environment. And so they will breed just, you know, millions of these flies, and then they will, you know...
So they'll outcompete the virile males.
Yeah. So the idea is that the females mate with a sterile male, and then try to produce offspring, they will fail. And so, and it has worked, right? And so they're trying to ramp that up in order to push back. They've halted cattle importation from Mexico because they're worried about it spreading into the U.S.
Good.
Yeah, so the idea is just to kind of overwhelm the population with sterile individuals. They use it in lots of things. They use it to control lampreys as well, too. It's not sterile insects, but they will release sterile males to try to control sea lampreys, which are an invasive species in the Great Lakes. They have this really cool machine. I have this video that I show my students when we talk about lampreys in my zoology class, where they are kind of feeding the lampreys, which is a long kind of snake-like fish, uh-huh. right? Jawless fish. But anyway, they feed it into the socket, and it just kind of sucks it up and takes it in, injects it with the sterilizing injection, and then shoots it back out into a tub. So it's kind of fun to watch.
It's a lamprey
right?
gun.
Yeah,
they're not quite eels, are they?
No, they're not eels, right? So they're not bony fish. They're jawless fish. They have a really great, cool, round mouth with all these scary looking teeth.
Oh, it's like a fish leech, isn't it?
Yeah, kind of like that, yeah. So what it does is it latches onto the side of a fish, mm-hmm. and it rasps off a bunch of flesh, and then it feeds off of all the stuff that's oozing out. Okay, so our last topic for this week has to do with something much less biological. So I'll hand it off to you, Matt. Fusion me up.
There was a recent breakthrough in nuclear fusion. So, look, a little bit of background. Nuclear fusion involves pushing two atomic nuclei together, making them merge into a single atom, and then collecting the energy that's emitted when that happens. Mm-hmm. Cool, right? The problem is that nuclei are all positively charged and don't want to get near each other. So in order to actually accomplish fusion, it requires insane amounts of pressure and temperature.
Yep.
They have to be really hot so the particles are moving really fast.
You can't do it with your pressure cooker.
You really can't do it with just a pressure cooker. No, no, no. There's a reason the sun does it so easily, because the sun is massive mm-hmm. and has huge amounts of gravitational crush. In order to generate that planet side, there are really... two ways to get around that sort of thing. Because if you need insane amounts of temperature and insane amounts of pressure, the obvious problem is how do you contain it? Mm-hmm. There are two branches of nuclear power research, and one of them is in magnetic confinement, and the other one is inertial confinement. Now, fans of fusion power research will be more familiar with the former. Magnetic confinement uses electromagnets in a donut-shaped chamber. So this is like what tokamaks and the stellarators are about
right.
on Earth. So this is not that. This okay. is the other side. So
forget everything he just said.
Right. This breakthrough is on the other side, the darker side, the nuclear weapon side. Inertial containment isn't looking for sustained plasma. They're looking for bursts of fusion energy being released, you know, like for a bomb. And in fact, this is how, you know, a fusion bomb works. They generate the heat and pressure needed to ignite fusion by detonating a bomb around the chamber, specifically a fission bomb, which in turn was ignited by a conventional explosive. So, a fusion bomb is three bombs and the worst kind of, like, Matryoshka doll you can imagine.
So this is how a hydrogen bomb works, is that right?
Oh, hydrogen bombs work, yeah.
A thermonuclear device. That's the really, really awful nuclear weapons, right?
Exactly.
That Edward Teller is responsible for, and that Oppenheimer did not want us to
Did not want us to try that, yeah. No. But, here we are. Fortunately, this type of inertial fusion uses lasers instead of explosives to achieve the burst of heat and pressure needed to ignite fusion in the target. And it was able to produce more energy from the fusion than it took to ignite.
Is this laser-based application, is this still weaponry, or is this something that could be applied in power generation?
Right. So this type would be used more for power generation. It is, however, this research was done by Los Alamos, Lawrence Livermore facilities. It is part of their stockpile stewardship program. Mm-hmm. Stockpile stewardship. Well, we have a nuclear arsenal. We haven't added to it since 1992.
Right.
So we have all these missiles sitting around that, of course, we want to be able to wave in other people's face because that's what a nuclear deterrent is about.
Right.
But we have to make sure that, one, they're still ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have a stockpile stewardship program to, keep doing the test. But that means that, if you got it on hand, you might as well do experiments with it.
Excellent.
Okay, so unfortunately, the wording of these articles is a little bit misleading. The energy that was gained by the experiment was more than it took to ignite it,
mm-hmm.
but that doesn't account for the amount of energy it takes to run those lasers to begin with.
Okay.
So, you have to admit that the energy that comes out of a flashlight
mm-hmm.
is less than the energy consumed by the battery of the flashlight.
Okay, right.
And so
that's... Because you're losing heat from
the batteries. You're losing heat. Yeah. There's always an efficiency issue. Still, it's in the right direction.
Oh, sounds really fascinating, but when am I going to be able to heat up a baked potato with this? That's what I want to know.
All we need to know.
Right.
I think
when will my Lean Cuisine be powered
by
a fusion reaction? That's what I want to know.
Fusion reaction. If you take your Lean Cuisine and set it out in the sunlight, it's going to happen.
That's
going to happen today.
It's powered by fusion power.
It's powered by fusion power. Isn't that amazing?
Well, then why are we wasting all of our time?
That's right. Well, I don't know. It feels good because it feels to me like fusion power is, I feel like it's in sight.
Uh-huh.
I feel like somewhere, I feel like I can almost see it.
All right. Well, I think that's it for the headlines. Up next, we need to take care of last week's sound science puzzler. Here it is again for your consideration. Matt, what was that sound? Did you pick up on the clue that I provided last time, the voyage home?
I mean, I picked up on it, yeah, but it was pretty well just slipped in there.
I was being subtle.
Extremely subtle.
That's what I'm known for.
Well, anyways, the voyage home, that's a Star Trek reference.
Yes, that is Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. And that was the sound of humpback whales. That was humpback whale song.
I thought whales, but I wasn't quite sure.
This is the very, very song that saved humanity from destruction in Star Trek IV. And they did this by communicating through whale song across the vacuum of space with a probe from some alien civilization that is constantly wanting to destroy the Earth. So the whale song is like a conversation. It's like, can we destroy the Earth? And then the whales are like, nope, not yet.
How are the whales communicating with the probe?
Well, that's...
Sound cannot travel through the vacuum of space.
That was my point in referring
to... What the heck?
I don't know. Maybe it is sound, but it is also maybe there is electromagnetic radiation being given off by the whales.
You are stretching so far.
Yeah. And then how...
You're trying to help them. I don't know.
I'm stretching light years. I am stretching light years. So then the question then again would be, how many light years away were these aliens?
Right, and there's no...
I guess the whales went extinct, and then there were a couple of centuries later, and then the probe shows up. But that suggests that they're within a couple of hundred light years. We're talking about the United Federation of Planets, which extends, around the whole Alpha Quadrant of the galaxy. I think you would be aware of whoever these probe people are if they were within a couple of hundred light years.
One would think.
I
gotta say, original series Star Trek is not my jam. So I'm not gonna sit here and defend classic Star Trek.
I loved this movie when it came out. It was so much fun, right? They traveled back in time to the 20th century to pick up whales.
It's always the 20th century. They always come back to
now. It was so much fun, but the premise is so asinine. It is hard to... we need to do it for Yakety Science Ruins the Movies. I think we just did, didn't we?
We should. Right. We could do all more. Right.
So that's it. Our sound science puzzle this week was Humpback Whale Song. Up later in the show, we will have a brand new sound science puzzle for you.
Totally natural thing in it. It's totally natural thing in it. It's... totally natural thing, and it's just...
Next up, we have Matt's Chemical Minute, a segment lasting 5 to 7 indeterminate units of time. Matt is going to tell us about an element, a compound, or some other chemical entity that we should care about. It'll be an element. He will then give this entity a rating of 1 to 5 stars. I will listen and then potentially argue with Matt about his rating. Today, Matt takes up that most magnetic of all elements, magnesium, atomic number 12. Magnetic in the figurative sense, of course. I don't believe that it is actually magnetic. But then, Matt, if it's not magnetic, then why does it have such a magnetic name?
Yeah, no, there actually is a lot of overlap between the name magnesium for our element today and for manganese, which is an element we'll talk about later, and then also magnetite and therefore magnetism. Okay. All of these words actually come from the same word, which is magnesia, which is a region in Greece occupied by a tribe called the Magnetes. Mm-hmm. And so they had all of these substances ended up being called magnesia. Mm-hmm. We had male magnesia, which was magnetite.
Male magnesia. So yes. It has gender.
It has gender. Go figure. Excellent. But it does. Okay. Male magnesia is magnetite, which is that naturally occurring magnetic iron ore, mm-hmm. right? And then we had female magnesia, which comes in two flavors, white magnesia and black magnesia. White magnesia is magnesium oxide, mm-hmm. Which is indeed whitish gray in color. And that's where we get our that's our connection to magnesium.
Right.
And then manganese dioxide is black in color. That's black magnesia.
And I'm guessing there's some sort of reaction that could cause a change that would make transnesia.
Possibly. Right. Yes. They haven't quite discovered it yet there, but yeah. But so all of those words, you know, we basically all got them all from magnesia.
Okay, and so if we went into, this is an ancient Greek region, and these are minerals that were known about a very long time ago. So if we want to read more about it, we go to Herodotus or to Homer.
He's probably got a section there on it. Yeah. I think it's nice that this is the first element on the periodic table, as we've been trolling our way through the periodic table, that is named after a place or a people.
Oh, really?
It's just going to happen more often. Yeah. But yeah.
It is, yeah, you've got Californium and so
on. Oh, absolutely. And there's like 18 elements named after Sweden. It's amazing.
Oh, the Swedes.
Absolutely. So, okay. So listeners are going to know magnesium from, for instance, milk of magnesia, which is, you know, your...
helps with heartburn.
Yeah, helps with... But yeah, Pepto-Bismol is a type of milk.
It counteracts the acid, the stomach acid. So it is an alkaline thing.
Indeed, it is. Magnesium hydroxide is what that is. Epsom salts are also magnesium sulfate. Mm-hmm. They're named Epsom because of that region in England where they were discovered first time. Yeah. They look funny when they are mined. The mineral magnesium.
What does it look like?
It looks like hairs.
Oh, really?
It's these weird hairs that grow up. It almost looks like asbestos.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
okay. like fibers.
Yeah, that kind of is very fibrous. Yeah. Okay, cool. Interesting little pictures you can get. Baby powder, talcum is magnesium silicate. Also, sparklers. If we're going to go into pyrotechnics and fireworks, stuff like that, sparklers use magnesium. You are setting magnesium on fire on those things.
Cool, yeah.
And so also flashbulb
those
photography.
Those things burn like the Dickens.
They really do. Oh, that's very white, extremely white. So white, it's actually a little bit UV.
No, I'm just talking, if the spark gets on you, right, the burns and...
Oh, yeah.
Not your eyes, but I'm saying it burns.
Oh, you mean physically it'll burn you.
Physically burn you, yes.
Well, it will do both. Yes. It will do both. It's insanely bright and insanely hot. People will sometimes use burning magnesium to ignite thermite.
Okay.
So they want thermite to burn, so they'll put magnesium on top of it, use the magnesium.
It's pretty close to sodium, but it doesn't behave exactly the same way in terms of oxidizing, right? So if you toss magnesium into the water, is it going to explode the
No,
way
it's
that,
not
that
going
sodium
to.
Is,
no.
Well, why
it,
is
it,
that?
It will oxidize just really slowly.
Okay.
I mean, it's just that big difference between only having one electron to lose, you know, for the alkali metals and having two electrons that they'd have to lose. The ionization energy is just not as favorable.
Okay.
Not as cool. The
If you set sodium on fire and put it on a sparkler, will that work?
That's a great idea. Let's try it. Sounds wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
Another experiment for Yakety Science Laboratories.
Biochemically, magnesium is pretty important. Yeah. Very, very important. There's like hundreds of enzymes that need magnesium ions, in their makeup, including like all of the ones that we use to make ATP.
Right.
Kind of important to have that ATP.
ATP, the power lines of the cell.
Is that what you call it?
That's what I call it. So because everybody says mitochondria is, of course, the...
Powerhouse
of the cell. People will repeat that even if they don't have any idea what it means.
Sure.
What it means is that this is where we're burning sugar to release the energy, and we put that energy into ATP. So we're releasing the energy, but we've got to get it out to where it's used. So the power plant needs power lines to connect it to all of the places where it's used. So
I like it. That's very, it's a nice visual sort of connection there.
Excellent.
Absolutely. Yeah, also, anytime you're trying to use nucleotides and you're making DNA and RNA, you need magnesium for that.
Good things, it's DNA and RNA.
It's a great thing, absolutely.
Yeah. RFK Jr. doesn't like it, but...
He probably doesn't.
I think magnesium is also connected to chlorophyll as well and photosynthesis. Is that right?
It is, absolutely,
isn't there magnesium sitting in the middle of chlorophyll?
Yep. It's almost like, you know, it's that poetry. We've got humans with their hemoglobin... Uh-huh. And we have iron in there to help us. And then plants have magnesium, another metal, to do their photosynthesis.
Mm-hmm.
It's poetry in motion is what it is. Wonderful element. I like it a lot. I don't have anything bad to say about it.
Yeah.
No, I really don't.
All right. Well, obviously you'll give it, I'm not going to take the words out of your mouth, but what's your rating?
My rating is, I'm going to give it 4 stars. 4 stars for magnesium.
You just draw ratings randomly out of a hat, don't you? Right?
It's that there's nothing wrong with it, and I do like many of the things it does, but there's not a special that special spark, you know.
It has. What are you talking about? It has a literal spark. It is what makes sparklers spark, right? So you said nothing bad about it. It literally has a spark, and yet you're giving it 4 stars. I just don't understand you, Matt. I'm giving it 5 stars.
Okay. Well, then as long see. That's why I didn't give it 5 stars,
right?
Because then you wouldn't give it 5 stars.
That's true.
This is my kindness.
This is reverse psychology.
That's how it goes. All right, magnesium average of 4.5 stars. Put it in the book.
And next up, we'll be dealing with phlogistinium.
No, phlogiston. We already did. That was optional.
I didn't say phlogiston. I said phlogistinium. Of course, you don't know about phlogistinium.
Apparently not. But I guess you're going to teach us.
I just made it up. Go ahead.
Awesome. No. Next element is aluminium. If you're from across the pond, aluminum. If you live here.
All right. So, you've chosen our pronunciation. So that means we have to go to England.
That's where we'll go.
We'll reconvene in the pub and. Talk about aluminium over a pint of bitters.
There we go.
Next time.
At the Green Dragon. Wasn't that Tolkien's pub of choice?
Yeah. All right. Next time on Yakety Science. Next up, we have Yakety Science Ruins the Movies. In this segment, we will take on a Hollywood blockbuster and pedantically explain how they got the science so incredibly wrong. Yes, we are those know-it-all people that you never want to take to the movies. We just can't enjoy ourselves, and we want to share that lack of joy with you. Our last episode, we took up the Disney classic, The Little Mermaid, and building upon that today... We will be looking at the following.
Ma chère mademoiselle, it is with deepest pride and greatest pleasure that we welcome you tonight. And now, we invite you to relax, just pull up a chair, as the dining room proudly presents your dinner. Be our guest. Be our guest. Put our service to the test. Tie your napkin round your neck, sherry, and we provide the rest. Soup du jour, hot hors d'oeuvre. Why, we only live to serve.
So, Matt, obviously that was Disney's Beauty and the Beast, the tale of Belle's kidnapping, right? And it's like a Stockholm Syndrome movie, right? She's kidnapped, and then she comes to... empathize with her captor, and eventually they get married and live happily ever after.
No, this is Beauty and the Beast, an animated Disney classic. I mean, you kind of ripped the doors open with that last time looking at Little Mermaid. So if we're going to shred the science of Disney classics, then I'm ready for it with this tale as old as time. So yeah, Beauty and the Beast, all right, so 1991 story of an unfortunate prince who is rude to a disguised and apparently fickle enchantress.
Yes.
He and his castle and entire staff are cursed, transformed the prince into a hideous beast.
Or... Yeah, those enchantresses, they don't recognize the problem with collective guilt, right?
They really and punishment. Don't. So many people. I mean, he gets turned into the hideous beast or not hideous beast, depending on your kink.
Yeah.
And the rest of the staff is transformed into furniture and dinnerware and supposed to be cursed until he learns to love.
This is the movie most beloved of furries out there.
Furries and bookworms. The overlap between furries and bookworms. That's where it is. Yeah. So my beef with this is not the Stockholm Syndrome. No, my beef is with the law of conservation of mass. Have you heard of it?
One of my favorite laws.
It's a good one.
It's a banger. Keeps things from disappearing on you.
All right. So what is it? Tell us.
It's a law that says that mass is conserved.
That is indeed the conservation of mass that mass is conserved. Can you expound on that?
That it can never not be conserved.
That's also a pretty good one. Mm-hmm. Good. You're definitely a biologist. I love that you give the most basic level. That's kind of the stuff like a student would give, you know, uh-huh. the sort of circular argument. You know?
Why don't you give us the chemist explanation?
All right. So the at the basic level, you can say, well, okay, yes, it means that mass is not created or destroyed, just converted from one form to another. It's kind of like the law of conservation of energy. Mm-hmm. Energy is not created or destroyed, just converted from one form to another. But neither one is real.
But mass can be converted to energy or energy to mass.
That's what I mean, yeah. Yes. So there is the neither one of those is actually real. They're mostly real for like the classic sense, you know, mm-hmm. for large bodies in closed systems. Mm-hmm. But when you talk about like nuclear chemistry, mm-hmm. quantum mechanics, mm-hmm. or just the vastness of space, then both laws kind of fall down. So special relativity gives us the mass energy equivalence. Mm-hmm. You may know this formula.
E equals MC squared.
That's the one. That's everyone right. knows it. Everyone likes it. No one knows what it means. But we're going to tell you what it means.
Like the powerhouse of the cell. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Like we can spout this equation out there. But what E equals MC squared, E energy, M mass, C is just our speed of light or mm-hmm. you know, whatever.
Right. Squared.
Indeed, squared. it means that if a system shows any, you know, actual loss of mass or gain of mass, then there would have been an equivalent gain in energy. Mm-hmm. So that means that you can actually lose mass if you turn it into energy, mm-hmm. and you can lose energy if you turn it into mass.
So this happens with like radioactive things where this they are they're giving things. Off mass and it's becoming energy, electromagnetic
Absolutely.
Waves.
Absolutely. Yes, it off. Really is. Yeah. So here's my deal. At the end of the story, the beast mm-hmm. is transformed back into his princely form. The beast, who is a rather imposing figure, mm-hmm. right? I estimated it. He seems like a bear, you mm-hmm. know?
Okay.
So I'd say like 400 pounds. He's changed into his human prince formed. He seems like a somewhat larger fellow, but kind of an average-sized human. Mm-hmm. He's not super beefy. 170 pounds, maybe?
Oh, more than that, yeah.
Well, let's keep
200.
It. Let's keep it 170, because that's what I did the math
you
on.
You did the math
on. And let's leave it that way. So where did the extra 230 pounds go?
He in the closet? I don't know.
He just left it somewhere. It had to have been converted into light. And indeed, actually, the end of the story, when he's transforming, doesn't he like shoot light from his fingers? You know, in part of the scene where he's transforming.
I'm sure that
when
sounds...
the curse is being lifted, it's you see light emitting from all of his appendages, or at least the ones we can see.
And you're going to tell me that that light would incinerate everything.
I'm around. Saying that that light should have been a lot brighter. the amount of light is much too small. I have done the math. Do you see this printout of my Excel sheet?
It's very impressive.
It is very impressive. So if we lost 230 pounds, that's about 104 kilograms of mass.
Okay.
All right. If we convert that into energy, using E equals MC squared,
right.
that comes out to 9.4 times 10 to the 18th joules. 9.4 times 10 to the 18th joules.
How many nuclear bombs?
Exactly. Yeah. The fat man dropped on Hiroshima was 8.8 times 10 to the 13th joules, mm-hmm. which means that the energy emitted by beast transformation at the mm-hmm. end would have released 100,000 atomic bombs.
100,000. Well, maybe what happened, because all of the, like, Lumiere and, you know, the clock and everything, the Cogsworth, those guys all get bigger. So maybe the mass was just transferred from the beast to those other characters.
I like where you're going with this. Unfortunately, I have already looked into that uh-huh. and done the math on it.
It doesn't work.
I had to watch Be Our Guest in slow motion in mm-hmm. some scenes just to be like, okay, how many creatures are there? Because, like, there are at least 300 staff at this castle. 300 of them.
300?
Yes. 300.
You counted all of those?
I did. I did. And then I was like, okay, I probably missed a few of these because I only did like the there's more in like the fight scene at the end.
Right. So
the coat hanger comes
right.
out.
So to Matt's students, if your papers have not been graded the past couple of weeks, this is why.
But other than the beast, only one other staff member, only one other person was transfigured into something of greater mass. And that is whatever coachman or groomsman was churned into the coach that takes Belle's dad home.
Okay.
You know, that thing. Everyone else is turning something much smaller than themselves. A person to a fork.
Uh-huh.
A child maybe into a teacup.
Uh-huh.
You know, but still, so that is a lot. So I did some quick and easy math. I took those 300 people. I assumed that I just blanket said, okay, they went down to a quarter of their size.
Okay.
That's about average probably. Okay. I think that's probably being, you know, generous.
Okay.
If we do that, same sort of math, then we are not emitting 100,000 bombs in that moment.
Okay.
That would be the equivalent of 15 million bombs.
Okay. But this would have happened at the beginning.
At the beginning. So yeah. At the beginning when they were transformed, everyone's
mm-hmm.
transformed,
mm-hmm.
then actually that poor Enchantress just nuked herself into oblivion.
The whole place would have been
right.
incinerated.
So if our original argument was the beast was blowing up France at the end, he was only able to destroy 18% of France with his detonation.
Okay.
But the rest of the staff, when they were originally transfigured,
mm-hmm.
that would be enough to destroy France, the entirety of France, four and a half times.
Excellent.
Over.
So France and Germany and Spain.
They
and
are just nuked to oblivion. This story never got to happen because that kid mouthed off to an enchantress and she nuked the world.
It's shocking that they didn't do these calculations. I mean, Disney,
right?
I mean, they have all these production assistants and animators and things.
I can't believe it.
And you did this and, you know, you spent, you know, what, 10 hours of your life doing this?
Absolutely. They should have been able to do this. They should be able to do that. No. Mm-hmm.
Oh, Disney. Will you ever stop lying to
us? I mean, there are 48 dancing candlesticks. There are 12 carts of food. There are 71... these weird, I don't know what they are, some sort of like dish with like a lid on it, a lidded dish dancing around.
Yeah,
not to count the plates. I didn't count the plates after a while because there were just stacks of them.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a big castle, lots of people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so no matter what, France is toast.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
That's what we have. Come back next time, listeners, for Yakety Science.
We'll be dealing with Dumbo next.
Right. What awful thing.
Elephants really fly? We'll find out next time.
Well, what's the wind airspeed velocity of an unladen elephant?
That's right. Only if they believe. What's the airspeed of a believing elephant, and what is the airspeed of an unbelieving elephant? Thanks, Matt. Ironikos prosphilos eleluth. So up next, we have our new sound science puzzler. In this segment, I will challenge you to identify a science-related sound. It could be the sounds made by an animal, physical phenomenon, or it could be something that is associated with science in some other way. Here is your new sound science puzzler. I'm sorry, Matt, could you stop tapping on the countertop so that we could do
I was making Jiffy Pop. You
so
want some?
So that we could, could you please finish up with your Jiffy Pop and your tapping on the countertop so that we can do the sound science buzzer? No, that was actually the sound. Here it is once again, one more time. All right. That's it. If you think you know the answer, send it to yakketyscience@gmail.com. Be sure to include your name, your phone number, your social security number, date of birth, and your mother's maiden name. All of those are much appreciated. We'll have the answer to this puzzler next time on Yakety Science. Well, that's it for this episode of Yakety Science. As always, we leave you with a wise, wise quote from a scientist of note. This week's quote comes from the very short-lived head of the CDC, director of the CDC, Dr. Susan Menares. She recently wrote in the Wall Street Journal, "Public health shouldn't be partisan. Vaccines have saved millions of lives under administrations of both parties. Parents deserve a CDC they can trust to put children above politics, evidence above ideology, and facts above fear. I was fired for holding that line, but the line doesn't disappear with me. It runs through every parent deciding whether to vaccinate a child, every physician counseling patients, and every American who demands accountability. If we stay silent, preventable diseases will return. If we act, the facts can still prevail." Dr. Susan Menares, former director of the CDC. With those bracing words, we leave you, dear listeners, until the next episode of Yakety Science. Thanks for joining us.
Bye now.
Yakety Science is produced, written, and edited by Matt Smith and Brian Cross. Production help provided by Scott Gregory. Theme music by Lobo Loco. Yakety Science is recorded at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa and at the Center for Creativity at Tulsa Community College. If you'd like to yak back at us, our email is yaketyscience@gmail.com. We love to hear from you.
Goodness. So there's just like, so the females come out and there's just hordes upon hordes of out there who are just like, absolutely, like, just infertile.
Do you think Scott is going to
let us say the word?
I'm pretty sure we're going to have to edit that part out.
But that is the scientific term.
Unless I bleep it out.
That's the term. That's what they call them.
Of course it is. Yes, it's the scientific term, definitely.
Mm-hmm.